Do you wonder where you fit in these changing technological times? Is the system excluding you or including you? I'm James Felton Keith, inviting you to tune in to Inclusionism, a new code of equity, every Sunday at 5:30 p.m.
Yep.
I'll interview leading activists, academics, diplomats, and business people about what it truly means to be included in the 21st century. That's Inclusionism, every Sunday at 5:30 p.m. on WHCR 90.3 FM, The Voice of Harlem. Welcome to Inclusionism. It's Sunday. It's 5:38 p.m. I'm your host, James Felton Keith. This is the show where we like to normally talk about exclusion and how we solve the problem of it, where we like to say individuals are at their best when they identify with the community, and communities are at their best when they identify all of their individuals. This week, we have Andy Stern as our guest, and a special guest, also Kalia Young is here from the West Coast. She's in town this week, and we're going to talk in the second part of the hour about her forthcoming book, Domains of Identity, coming out on Anthem Press. But before we get to Kalia, Andy Stern is the president emeritus of the largest labor union on the planet or in the United States?
In the United States.
In the United States, the Service Employees International Union. And he's a fellow at the Economic Security Project, among other things. Look, this guy is everywhere from, you know, hanging out with Jesse Jackson, or at least that's what's on Google still right now, to bouncing around New York and the rest of the country. So, Andy, thanks for coming up to Harlem Sunday evening.
Great place to be on Sunday.
Yeah, I'm actually pretty exhausted. I'm running on coffee right now. I've been at the African American Day Parade and a series of political events per that since around 8 o'clock this morning, and so it feels like midnight to me. But we're here. Andy, I want to jump right into it since we only have 30 minutes today and go right into presidential politics. So I was introduced to Andrew Yang by you some time ago, I think April or so of 2018. And I was watching recent videos of him, and you are credited as the architect of his Freedom Dividend, which is a universal basic income of $1,000 a month. And you wrote a book called Raising the Floor a while back, but was sort of a front runner in the most modern movement talking about universal basic income. Our listeners know that it's an old topic. It's hundreds of years old, but there's a resurgence of this conversation in the modern political lexicon. But you being a UBI guy, on top of being, you know, at the top of the game as a union and a labor guy, is quite unique. So what brought you there? Like, when you were writing that book, you were thinking what?
I was thinking that for all the work I was doing in the union every day, and for the incredible heroism that our members were showing, they just weren't getting ahead. You know, and for years, people kept saying, you know, people are working harder and they're not getting a raise. And all the economists would say, well, it's just a temporary problem. We're in the bottom of the curve. It always comes up. And after 40 years, I think everybody's now admitted something very different is happening in the economy. And so when something different is happening, you have to decide, do the same old ideas get you where you want to go, which is to give people that work some decency and security in life? And so for me, the more I looked, the more I realized this was not just greedy corporations, although they certainly had a role to play in it, and wasn't just the government working on behalf of the well-connected, which it certainly did, but there was a basic underlying economic change that was going on, and technology was taking away people's jobs. It was holding down wages. The American dream was dead, and we needed a new idea.
The American dream was dead. That's a quote.
That's a sad one, too.
It is. I think, yeah, I'm I don't like to, I always feel weird talking about myself like an old man, like I've been around a bit, but I was a part of that last group who thought we, you know, you graduate from high school, you go to college, you get the right job, you do all the right things, you buy a house. I bought a house right before the financial crisis because my parents said it was the best investment I could ever make. They were extremely excited. And then the market went, you know,
right
down.
Right.
And I know, so you, around that time, 07, 08, 09, you were coming into, you were at the SEIU, I mean, as president in 2010?
No, I became president in 96, actually.
Oh, 90, oh.
Yeah.
Right, but so you left in 2010.
2010,
I mean.
That's
right.
Correct, yep.
So those last few years, that's really what I meant to say, of your 10-year, you started to see, it was tech? I mean, you were thinking, so this is tech. This is,
well,
tech
I was thinking,
is
you know, what I was thinking was, boy, this is strange. When I graduated college, you either got a union job or you got a college degree, you were fine.
Sure.
Right. You know, and all of a sudden, you know, and then people say, well, now more and more people need college degrees. You just can't graduate high school, except everybody was, except everybody graduated from college wasn't getting a decent job. So, you know, it just, you know, and everybody kept saying, well, it's just, it's going to change, or we need more education, or it's skill training. And no matter what we did, nothing changed. And the one thing that really became clear to me is when President Obama passed Obamacare, you know, we got more health care for more people than every union had ever bargained for in the history of America, because we created a social system that works. So you have the unions, which were doing a really good job for its members, but they were shrinking and shrinking.
Sure.
And so now what do we do when the whole economic system isn't working for people and there really aren't unions as there used to be in most occupations to make the difference and sort of share in the success of these companies like Google and Amazon? You know, so workers are getting in trouble, and old answers didn't work. And so you begin to think, well, what would work? And you know, my research assistant actually stayed up all night long because he said to his wife, I'm going to come in, I'm going to tell this union guy, I have this idea, we're going to pay people for not working. And he said, he's probably going to fire me the next day because, like, the union people don't believe that people should get paid for not working.
Oh, I don't know. So you had a guy on this.
Yeah, he was like, no, I was saying, okay, what's the solution? And, of course, I thought it's guaranteed jobs. Of course, we just have to give everybody a job and then, you know, that'll be the problem. And he knew that there's just all kinds of issues with guaranteed jobs, which we can talk about. So he said, you know, he had been reading about universal basic income. And so he wrote me a six-page paper and did an. He said, I want a half hour of your time. I don't want you to, like you normally do, interrupt me. Just let me get it out. And so he lays out this whole thing from Thomas Paine to Richard Nixon to Martin Luther King and onward. And it's like, I said, that's pretty interesting. I never really kind of understood all that.
I like that you said, though, that that your natural sort of inclination was, you know, guaranteed jobs. I do find that even as I am deep in the UBI conversations with folks, I don't think that they empathize enough with, you know, legacy knowledge and the fact that, you know, when people think about, well, how do we solve these problems? They just go, well, we should do more of what we used to do instead of going, what's the most radical new thing that we haven't heard of in a while? Because even though UBI was a thing that folks were talking about in the 60s and the 70s, and obviously way before that in Thomas Paine's day. Milton Friedman talked about it in the 50s. But outside of the middle of the 20th century, we hadn't really heard of it. And so that's two generations. You got the Gen X folks, the millennials. Now you have these Gen Z kids who are 20 or something like that. And a lot of us hadn't heard of universal basic income at all. So we think it's just this brand new thing. But I like that you mentioned that because I think for the people who are really gung-ho about it in this Andrew Yang era, they're really sort of, I see them kicking the jobs guarantee folks on Twitter. And these are real people. Whether folks
The jobs guarantee as a choice you know, is interesting. The problem with the jobs guarantee is, first of all, most people really don't like their jobs that much.
Sure.
And jobs are probably the biggest cause of poverty right now. It's like people are working and they're poor.
Sure.
People are underemployed.
Sure.
And, you know, are we going to create a situation where we take all the women and people of color and make them childcare and home care workers, take all the mostly white guys and make them infrastructure people, and we just sort of recreate kind of the divisions and the inequality in our society that got us here, or does it even get worse because it becomes like welfare and then it's like Cutter.
Right.
And you have all these Republicans who are like, yeah, they should just be out picking up trash along the road.
Yeah.
You know, like a chain gang for 8 hours a day, you know, because they got to work for their job.
It is a culture, and that happens. Like, I've met formerly poor people here in the city who live on the Upper East, who come from somewhere else, and like, you know, these people just really need to pull up their bootstraps and work. And I'm like, you married into a couple of million, you bastard. But anyway, I do agree. I think a very real resentment can proliferate. And if we pick bosses to pick winners in these jobs, then, you know, you're right. I think all the same social sentiments that exist right now would just continue to endure.
And there's really never been an experiment. There's been plenty of experiments about giving people cash, you know, that have either gone on or are going on that have shown really good results. Yeah. There's really no jobs program, you know, that we've ever created that hasn't ended up, you know, putting people in kind of low wage, you know, bad situations, you know, with, you know, matchbook truck drivers or community colleges that really don't have jobs at the other end are going to college right now and ending up with a lot of debt. So we really haven't created a jobs program. And that's what I keep saying to the jobs guarantee. I'm not against it. Like, show me what it is and tell me how we're not going to end up with a lot of poor people with no benefits, but they have a job. Well, so do fast food workers and so do home health care workers, but they're not very good jobs.
I'm with you 100%. Mm-hmm. You know, I was just with a bunch of labor economists at NYU, and they're like, look, there's no, I think any economist in this space, myself included, would say, you know, there's no job shortage. They just don't pay. And they haven't been paying for really my whole lifetime, which is nearly 40 years. And so it's really more than that, really nearly 50 years at this point. And so that's a compounded problem. So you and I mean, we talk often about, you know, these topics. I want to tumble down a million rabbit holes, but we only have so much time here. And so I really want to dig into two things. Number one, as the UBI guy, you know, who sort of led us into, you know, one of the folks who led us into this decade talking about UBI, which crazily enough is almost over. It's weird to me to think about that we're getting ready to go into another decade and I'm alive. But as that person, first, like, how do you feel with how people are gobbling up the rhetoric coming out of not only Yang's campaign, but the fact that other candidates are starting to talk about UBI, number one. And number two, I really want to spend a minute thinking about if there is an opportunity to make this rhetorically palatable for union leaders here in New York and everywhere else. Like, I really want to crack that code with you. I think about it all the time, and I think, should I text Andy another crazy question that's really going nowhere because I'm thinking out loud? I mean, so yeah, but how do you feel first? Like, how does it, you know?
Well, you know, it was amazing yesterday. I watched two things that said a lot. One was Whoopi Goldberg arguing with Tom Steyer, who's running for president, and asking him after he had given his whole retinue of ideas and things, well, what's wrong with just giving people money?
Yeah. Right. Like,
what's wrong with that Yang guy? You know what he's doing.
Right.
He seems to like it. Seems simple. It's straightforward. It's easy to do. So that was like, wow, we've hit, you know, hit kind of popular culture here with her. And then the same time, there was a video on Twitter of some clearly person who identified themselves as a former Trump voter who was explaining why UBI was a good thing for people like him. You know, for the truckers and workers who
he deserves it.
Yeah, he deserves it, right? And it's like, as he said, you know, we all own this country, so why shouldn't we all get a dividend, right? You know, it's like, why do the shareholders only get dividends? Why do wealthy people only get dividend? Why don't we all get a dividend? Because we all keep the country free, we keep the economy rolling, we all do our share. You know, so it's that's one conceptual way to deal with it. I think the other thing is, if you're, you know, I think people need money whether or not there's an automation problem or not. Like they need health care, whether there's, you know, Medicare for all or a public option. The whole goal has to be, it has to be cheaper. And I think the real problem with health care now is people just paying too much out of their pocket. If someone was really smart, besides talking about all the different programs, they say, no American's going to pay more than $1,000 a year out of their pocket for health care, period, goodbye.
I like that. You know, I pay too much for health care.
Exactly, right. So even when you have health care now, too many people are got copays, deductibles, premium shares that sort of make you not really want to use it or have to use so much of it. Exactly. So to me, there's a cost question as well as kind of how do we design the system. But to me, it's like if people aren't making enough money, then we have EITC, which is a way to give people cash, you know, very complicated way. People don't really understand it.
Sure. Can you define it for the listeners?
Yeah, it's the earned income tax credit, which allows low-wage workers, people with children who don't make a certain amount of money, to get basically a refund, an extra refund off their taxes to kind of reward them.
Right.
You know, Social Security is just a cash transfer, which allows you to get cash.
But it's two transactions too many. I shouldn't have to give it and get it back. I should just
So the question really is given all the wealth that exists in this country, given the fact that people, as Andrew likes to say, like Amazon, are paying no taxes, and Google and others are just minting money, you know, out in California, you know, why don't we create a system that just helps everybody get ahead? And I say the reason I know UBI works is because what I call parental basic income. Mm. It's all the parents, like all my friends, who are helping their kids out, you know, helping pay for college, or even having them live at home, or fixing their car if something goes wrong, or paying that doctor bill. Mm-hmm. They're providing stability in their life by giving their kids cash, right? Why can't everybody have stability in their life by knowing every month a check is coming in? And why doesn't that give you the choice? Like, rich people, lots of them work really hard, but they don't have to. Sure. They choose to, and their kids don't have to, and their wives and cousins and uncles and grandkids don't have to. They choose to do that. Poor people have no choices. Yeah. You just got to work for the man and make that money because you got rent, you got responsibility. And to me, the freedom to have a choice and a certain amount of support, even if you don't have rich parents, you know, is be what every American deserves.
I agree. I think the thing that we run into, in other parts of the country, is sort of a moral issue around it. Up here, you know, I would love to be in the engineer that I am, but running a congressional campaign, we just tell people that they're owed it. Just like that guy in Ohio, say, yeah, you deserve it. And I've gotten feedback from, you know, internet people that, oh, those words about entitlements, and they invoke, we all know entitlement meant something different, especially in the 80s and 90s. It can be dangerous, especially people who email me and go, well, you know, if black people are going to get it or feel entitled to it, it's a problem. But the reason I'm wearing this We Owe Us hat right now is because we mainly just talk to folks about ownership, because even they come back to us, well, and they go, well, why do I deserve this? And so then you have to tell this larger story around how the economy works, how their value proliferates, and how they should get a piece. And so that leads me to thinking about unions. You know, these large, you know, institutions, not as large as they used to be, but still large, still heavily influential, especially in Democratic politics. Is there, have you started to hear a sort of language used by them that might seem like it opens the door to a UBI on top of the wages that they're normally negotiating for?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you talk about it as a supplement, you know, to whatever else you're getting, either by work or by the government, you know, then people kind of understand, oh, it's like EITC, but it's just different a little bit, you
I
know.
Like that.
So I also, you know, think that we, you know, if you believe, and I know a lot of people do, that you should earn it, then fine, let's have 2 years of national service. And service can be a very broad term. You know, between your 18 and 21, you do national service for a couple of years, and just like the GI Bill,
a lot of
you
people
earn
talk
something.
About corps, of some sort.
You can do Corps, you can go to the military, you can work in a nursing home, you can do lots of things.
Yeah.
You know, that could be the guaranteed job period, that short period of time. And maybe every 10 years you go do like you do in the reserves, you know, two weekends or a month, doing some additional service to re-up your grant.
But we build a dam, we build a wall.
Exactly.
I mean, we don't build a wall.
So I just think, you know, I'm not against sort of conditioning on about something that's for the common good, right? Not for private interests.
One thing I said to the CWA workers was, I talked about a UBI as a bonus that I said, you know, I've been in some executive roles in my career, and usually when you come in, you sort of negotiate a signing bonus just like, you know, any top talent would. But most people don't have the opportunity to negotiate a bonus on top of their wage. And so the way I tried to explain it, which, and you know, I've been trying out different things to see what works, and maybe we can spread the wealth to tell other folks. But what came back is they were like, oh, okay, this is the bonus that we would never get the opportunity to negotiate. So I say, sure, you're working for $15, you know, you want to do raise the wage, fine. But this is the bonus that you wouldn't be allowed to negotiate for previously. And the kick with organized labor is I would hope that they would want to negotiate this across the board for folks first to say, on top of what you're giving our guys that work for any institution, we require this bonus because we're the input to this institution's productivity. Period.
Yeah, I mean, I think I think Andrew's conception of this is a dividend.
Yeah,
you know, people kind of get dividend.
Love the dividend.
Yeah, yeah. So I think
market people get it.
Yeah, and I think
I've talked to union people, and they go, "What's a dividend?" Yeah. Over and over again.
Yeah, well, it's what they
like
get. Yeah, well, it's what they get that pays for their pension. Yeah,
you
know, they invest their pension every year. The price goes up, and
yes.
they get a dividend. And where you buy a bond, and you get a dividend. You have a savings account, you get interest, a dividend. You can call it interest if you don't want to call it dividend. I mean, listen, Norway took all of its oil resources, right? Created quote a sovereign wealth fund, which is just an invest fund.
Yep.
And they give the money back to the people. Alaska
yep.
did it with oil.
Yep.
And I think as your next guest, you might talk about, why don't we do it with data?
Why don't we do it with data? You're right.
You know, let's create. We have the new oil
yep.
of the 21st century. It's called data. We have data brokers and people making a fortune.
It.
They're selling your information back to you by
right.
making you, you know, enticed to buy things, you know, and know things about you that influence commercial transactions. So, yeah, if oil was good enough for Norway, maybe Dayton is good enough for the United States.
On that note, I wish we had an hour to wrap. But we're going to take a quick break. Andy, thank you for your insights, for your time. Hopefully we can have you back and tumble further down this rabbit hole.
Well, thank you for keeping this issue
yeah.
way up in the forefront.
We got to do it, man.
People need money.
Plain and simple. People need money. On that note, yeah, we will... We'll be right back. Thank you, Andy.
You're listening to WHCR 90.3 FM, the Voice of Harlem.